I got a telephone call from a Greek priest friend of mine. He's the main organizer for the Orthodox Christian Fellowship's college retreat that takes place at Abbess Marcellus Monastery in Dunlap. And I've been going there for years. And he and I become good friends. And he called me one day and he says, the Greek Archdiocese just did a poll. And in the past, the Greeks always claimed to be the largest Orthodox church in this country in numbers. But what we all suspected was they're counting Greeks. They're not counting parishioners. They're counting Greeks. And so they did this study, and they came up with, well, actually, we are about 800,000. And then Father Apostolos said, in all actuality, that's probably still an inflated number. The OCA many years ago, same thing. They had these inflated numbers so they could tax parishes and so on. I don't think they do that anymore. But the truth is that all of the Orthodox churches in this country, if we're really serious about this, are losing membership. There was a time when, for the great blessing of waters at Holy Virgin Cathedral in San Francisco, there would be a procession with thousands of people that would go down to the water, to the seacoast, past Cliff House. They don't do that anymore. Yeah. They have a little procession around the church and they bless the water outside. I was talking to one of my Capuchin friends and he said he remembers when there was a rosary service in Golden Gate Park that 500,000 people showed up for when he was young. He was a young Italian in San Francisco. 500,000. Where are all those people? And even the mega churches, in order to keep the numbers, they have to have a gimmick to keep people coming in because there's nothing that they're not really getting fed. So in short time, people are leaving that. The Mormons, same thing. You know, the Mormons have a certain number that they quote about how many Mormons there are. They don't usually, and they usually count Jack Mormons. You know, the ones that are sort of Mormon but not. But that there's a whole other number now of people who are ex-Mormons. And the Mormon Church isn't tallying them. They're gone, but we don't want to admit it. We don't want to look at it. What is the solution to this? The solution, I believe, can be found in historic ancient Christianity, lived authentically. And that's what we are all called to do. A number of years ago, I founded an organization that sort of sprang out of the college retreat in Dunlap, because I noticed that these young men who came together once a year, I was there with the young men for two sessions, and there was a nun from back east that was there with the young women for two sessions. And I'm looking at these young men who are so excited to get together once a year, and then they're dispersed around the country or on the West Coast. And it hit me that, well, what if they're not dispersed? What if they're bound together all the time, year in and year out? So I proposed to a bunch of these guys, what do you think about founding a lay brotherhood, which is a very traditional thing in Orthodox countries, especially Norway, especially Russia. So we founded a lay brotherhood called the Salish, after the Salish Sea around the island, the Salish Brotherhood of St. John the Wonder Worker. And I got a call one day from my confessor, Father
Nicholas Letton heard about it. He's in Portland. And Father Nicholas called and he said, you know, the last person that founded a lay brotherhood was St. John. So I feel like St. John was behind the inspiration for this, and that we dedicated it to him as our patron. We now number 60 or 72. And we have twice yearly retreats at the monastery, so as many of the guys that can come do. And we have our own invitation-only Facebook page. So when these guys, they communicate all the time with each other. I rarely enter into that. I'm watching to see if there's any counsel that needs to come from a priest. But I'm watching in amazement of these guys networking with each other and supporting each other. Oh, my girlfriend just dumped me. You know, and the other guy's stepping in there and, you know, hanging there. Or I'm having doubts about my faith. Whoop! They're all there supporting them. And, you know, that's what we need. And you know, my whole, most of my adult life has been focused on youth. When I was teaching my high school, when I was teaching at St. Mary's College High School in Berkeley, before that when I taught college psychology. And what I tried to do as a teacher is I tried to emulate the teachers that impacted me in my life. They certainly weren't the ones that stood behind a podium with a manuscript that made your eyelids go closed when you saw the manuscript. Like, oh my gosh, one of those. Can't we just read this on our own in a coffee house? And yet, that is what so many of our clergy think is orthodoxy. And it's not. You know, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't have academic pursuits in the Orthodox Church. Absolutely we should. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have scholars. We need them. I need them. And we all have those moments in the Divine Liturgy when everything is serious. Where, you know, it's not a place to just pal around with your friends. That's what the Agape Feast is for. My Capuchin friend, Father John, who is the pastor at the St. Francis Shrine downtown in North Beach. And he wears his habit all the time. Most of the Capuchins now wear their habits. And I think a lot of it is our association with them, because they've been friends for years. And they saw, when they would be with me, the value of dressing like we do. And so now they... So I was over there with Café Turiesque having cappuccinos on Thursday with Brother Peter, who's the guardian of the house in Berkeley, and Father John, who's the pastor of that parish there, of the shrine. And so we're sitting out there with all these white bearded old guys that are neighborhood people. And we're just having a good time. And Father John is a lot like I am, you know, he's outgoing and he schmoozes with everybody in the neighborhood. And the best part of it is that all of those Italian restaurants, they love him because it reminds them of Italy. And most of them are from Italy. And then once they've been there, worked a year or two, and they have their green card, they'll move on, and then they'll bring in a bunch of others. So you go into some of these restaurants, and all you hear is Italian spoken. So the best thing that these Capuchins have and going for them, and me by extension, because I'm their friend, is we get a free bottle of wine with our dinner. and those stacks of hors d'oeuvres. I even took a picture of it. It was so beautiful. But when I'm at the Café Trieste, I told the barista, I said, "This, there's rumors that this place is going to close, and it can't close, I'll sue." This is the first coffee house that I ever went into, back when I was 22 in 1840. And when I went in there, it was also the very first coffee house on the West Coast. And it was in that Italian neighborhood. And well, I remember the very first time I went in there, the jukebox was playing Italian opera. Now, how many jukeboxes around the world have opera? They do. They have other music too, but they have opera. And so we're sitting there and just sort of lapping up this beautiful culture of the Italian coffee house. And that's the place where if I was there in civvies, there would be no impact. I would just look like another old bohemian sitting there. But And these are people who are not religious. They're not Catholics that are hanging out there. They're not religious. But when they see the three of us together, these two captains and I, who are bantering with each other and having a good conversation with the people that are hanging out there for their coffee. That was also, by the way, the first time I went in there. I know it will be hard for you to believe, but at one time, stand up for a minute here. One time I was probably about as thin as you are, and I had dark brown hair. I parted it in the middle, and it came down to my shoulders, and I had a trimmed, or a bushy beard, big beard, and I also had dark granny glasses. So, do you know who they thought I was?
John Lennon.
John Lennon. I started a flurry of activity. I had gone with two of my friends that were visiting. We were visiting San Francisco for my first time, and I went into this little shop that was on Grant Street. It's no longer there, and I spent $98 that I didn't have, and I bought a pair of extra flared bell bottoms, a silk shirt, you know, the kind that plunges down like here and open, and a sport coat from England that had a belt, a cloth belt in the middle, buttons up like this. It was so British, you could imagine. And I walked out of that store, and we walked down for my very first time into the Cafe Trieste. And on the way down there, some tourists stopped me. "Oh, can we have your autograph?" And I looked at them, and, "Oh, we never thought we'd ever meet you. John, you are our hero."
"Oh, gosh."
"John?" Oh, and they called one of their friends. "It's John Lennon." So I signed. But I signed with my real name and keeping honest. And as they walked away, we're probably the only people who know John Lennon's real name. Did you know that John Lennon's real name was David Parsons? But see,
that's a good one.
Bringing one of the things that Blessed Dimitri of Santa Rosa said to me soon after I was tonsured, and I remember, you know, there's a real different experience when you're dressed like this, and all of a sudden you're now dressed in monastic garb all the time. And everywhere you go, people are looking like,
what is this? And even to this day, I'll have people that are out somewhere with me, and they'll say, oh my gosh, everybody stares at you.